You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, a 10,000 specimen spider collection was donated to UW Green Bay earlier this year. We'll find out what this collection means for arachnid research. First, back in Wisconsin's primary election, Donald Trump had a lot of trouble with the solidly conservative counties outside of Milwaukee. Texas Senator Ted Cruz beat Trump in those counties by a 35-point margin. Looks like the presumptive GOP nominee is having some trouble getting voters in that area excited about his candidacy. Also earlier today, a third Wisconsin GOP delegate pulled out of the convention, meaning the party will have to come up with an alternate. One delegate cited Trump's candidacy as the reason for pulling out. One, scheduling concerns. A third gave no reason. Craig Gilbert joins us for more on Trump's lingering issue with the state's Republican voters. He's Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He writes the Wisconsin Voter blog. Veronica Rickert talked to him last week.
Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be with you.
So can you give us the broad outline? How is Donald Trump's support among Wisconsin Republicans looking right now?
Well, it's looking better than it did in March, which is not saying a whole lot because his numbers were really abysmally bad leading up to and through the Wisconsin primary, where he actually had negative ratings in his own party, which means more people had an unfavorable view of him than had a favorable view of him in Wisconsin. And these are Wisconsin Republicans who you would normally expect to be overwhelmingly behind their party's presumptive nominee. So those numbers have improved. I mean, now he's got a positive rating, but they're nothing like what we're used to seeing from a party's presumptive nominee at this point in the race. They're nothing like Mitt Romney's in 2012. He's also, you know, facing a candidate who's got her own problems in Hillary Clinton, but it's clear he's still, there's still some lingering hangover from the Wisconsin primary, which was probably Trump's worst primary of any state. He clashed with the governor, he clashed with conservative talk radio, his whole political style didn't seem to go over very well in Wisconsin, even with Republicans. So he's got, he's still got some work to do to get where he needs to be if he wants to put Wisconsin in play in November.
Well, obviously he'd like to carry Wisconsin. It is a battleground state, but still it is a single state, usually votes blue, at least in recent history, in the general election for president. So given all that, why do you think Donald Trump should be concerned about Wisconsin?
Well, you know, he's got the Republicans are facing have been facing kind of a shrinking electoral map. They have to find ways to expand the map because they've lost ground. Some states like Colorado and Virginia that used to be safely Republican are now in play. In some cases, they've been voting Democratic and they're becoming more Democratic. So Republicans have to find some states that have been voting Democratic and try to flip them. And so Pennsylvania would fall into that category, Michigan, Wisconsin. These are states that Democrats have been able to carry, but in some cases, in some years, they've been very close. And if you remember during the George W. Bush elections of 2000 and 2004, he came within a fraction of a percentage point of winning Wisconsin. Then the state wasn't so competitive during the Obama elections. But these are states that are demographically kind of open to a candidate like Donald Trump because they're very white and very blue-collar, but he just has not shown a lot of strength in Wisconsin. He's shown a little bit more strength in Pennsylvania. But in order to put a state like Wisconsin in play, at a minimum, he needs to have a unified party, and he needs to be a candidate that's going to mobilize really Republican parts of the state. And that's actually those are the parts of the state where he's actually been at his weakest, where he was at his weakest in the primary, and where he still is showing some softness in the polling.
And you're talking basically those parts of Wisconsin you're talking about are the ring of counties around Milwaukee. What is it about those counties that makes them so crucial for Republicans?
Well, because they not only contain a lot of Republicans, but they vote at extraordinary rates. I mean, these are counties that are among the highest turnout counties in the country. And so they not only turn out in large margins, but they deliver really one-sided margins for Republicans. So Republicans need to run up a score in southeastern Wisconsin in those suburban and exurban counties in order to kind of counteract the big landslides that Democrats get in places like Milwaukee and Madison. And that's, you know, I would stress that that's kind of a minimum of what Republicans have to do to be competitive in the state, because they obviously also have to do well in other parts of the state, but they're not going to be in the game unless they unless these counties continue to really perform at high levels for them. And that's what's kind of worrisome for Donald Trump, because these are the Republicans that have had the most trouble getting behind them. They're in the case of the suburban counties outside of Milwaukee, they have higher levels of income and education. They're very conservative, and in some cases, there's sort of a conservative skepticism of Donald Trump. So he's got a lot of things going against him. Conservative media in that part of the state has been hostile to Donald Trump. He's got a lot to overcome.
Do we know anything about whether these voters in these counties, these particular counties, are saying, you know, we're so lukewarm on Donald Trump that we may not vote at all? What do we know about how turnout might look?
Well, we're not going to know, obviously, until November, but there are some signs. There were some signs in the last poll that the Marquette Law School did in June where kind of a warning sign for Republicans was that Democrats were more likely to say they were certain to vote than Republicans were. That's kind of a measure of motivation and intensity, and usually it's the other way around. Usually Republicans have the edge because they tend to vote at higher rates than Democrats. So that's troubling. And we'll see if that continues. Those numbers can bounce around. But, you know, there's evidence out there that there's a little bit of an enthusiasm gap working against Republicans now. At the same time, you know, there are Democrats that are unenthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. There's Bernie Sanders supporters who have to come around if Hillary Clinton is going to unify the Democratic Party. But right now, it seems Donald Trump has a bigger problem than she does in that regard.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert right now, talking about Donald Trump's potential problems with Republican voters in Wisconsin. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Craig, I know you spoke with GOP Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, who's from the southeastern Wisconsin area, his district, about what voters' feelings were. I mean, what are voters saying about their feelings about Donald Trump?
Well, you know, Wisconsin's interesting because you get the whole spectrum of reactions, of Republican reactions to Donald Trump. We've certainly seen it among elected officials and politicians like Jim Sensenbrenner and Scott Walker and Paul Ryan. I mean, it ranges from, you know, will not support Trump under any circumstances to begrudging support to a little bit more enthusiasm. But I think you see the same thing in the Republican electorate. A lot of reservations. I mean, these are people that, again, during the Republican nominating fight, saw Donald Trump come in and attack the state's Republican governor, clash with Paul Ryan. I mean, these are the two most popular Republicans in Wisconsin, and then be excoriated on conservative talk radio. So, you know, Donald Trump is not getting a lot of reinforcement in the state from his own party. It's going to be really interesting to see if that changes at the convention, where Paul Ryan of Wisconsin is going to be chairing and Reince Priebus of Wisconsin is the RNC chair. And Scott Walker, the governor, will be speaking. But it's interesting that even Scott Walker today or this week in reiterating the fact that he would support the nominee against the Democrat wouldn't even say his name. So there's a coolness there that is probably not helpful to Donald Trump when it comes to mobilizing Republicans. Republicans are concerned about that because they're concerned about its effects down ballot on the Senate race and on other races around the state.
And yet we heard this week that Scott Walker is going to be speaking at the Republican convention. Do you anticipate any kind of change of tone, maybe more full-throated approval of the candidate?
Well, I mean, that's what's going to be interesting to watch, because that would be a real change of tune. And, you know, so far what we're getting is these kind of robotic, we've been getting these from a lot of Republicans, these kind of robotic, you know, statements of, you know, routine, anything you know, you'd support routinely from any politician, I will support my nominee, but not a lot of specific praise for Donald Trump. They're not making the positive case for Donald Trump. They're making the negative case against Hillary Clinton. And that's what, if we do see that at the convention, where you would expect to see that, that will be a change and a shift. It would certainly be helpful to Republicans, but it's not going to be easy for these Republicans. I mean, take Scott Walker. He was Donald Trump excoriated him during the campaign, ridiculed him, made fun of him, attacked his record, drove him out of the race, arguably. And so, and he spent months kind of, you know, coyly, you know, in a very coy and ambiguous way, you know, hinting that he might not support Donald Trump in the end, hinting that the race could still be open, talking about delegates being allowed to vote their conscience. And for him to turn around now and give sort of a full-throated endorsement of Donald Trump, you know, it may just, you know, it would be a little jarring to hear that at this point.
You mentioned the role that conservative radio has played in some of the issues that Trump may be having with Republican voters in Wisconsin. Has that tone shifted? I mean, at the primary, there was a strong Never Trump movement in Wisconsin, especially in those southeastern counties. But is that anything that you've seen change over the past months?
Well, I think yes and no. I mean, I think that he's continuing to get criticism. He's continuing to be bashed by his critics, a lot of his critics on conservative talk radio. But I think what's shifting is, you know, the new focus, I think, is sort of anti-Clinton more than anti-Trump. So there is a dynamic that happens as we get closer to the election where Republicans and conservatives become more and more focused on defeating Hillary Clinton. And obviously the nominating race is behind them. So the question is whether making the case against Clinton is going to be enough to motivate those voters. She's certainly a motivating force for a lot of Republicans, just as Donald Trump will be a motivating force for a lot of Democrats. It's one of those elections where the intensity is not pro, it's anti on both sides.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
That's political reporter Craig Gilbert discussing Donald Trump's lingering issues, convincing Wisconsin Republicans to support him in the general election. He talked to Veronica Rickert last week. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a major spider collection amassed over a 30-year career was donated to UW Green Bay earlier this year. We'll talk to an arachnologist about the collection and what it means for UW Green Bay. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
There are many high-tech ways to fish these days. But Ron Weber prefers to fish the simple way his grandfather taught him as a kid.
A bald eagle stared at me from a towering white pine as I slid the boat out of my truck. Pulling the rowboat to the water's edge brought a series of chirps from the eagle. He wasn't happy about sharing the remote Northwoods Lake on this June evening. I hoped the eagle wouldn't hold it against me for trying to catch a few largemouth bass from the numerous blowdowns that lay in the dark, stained waters. A few strokes of the oars brought me to where the top half of a balsam fir had fallen into the lake. As my bait raced across the surface a second time, a 12-inch bass found it too tempting. After a brief tussle, the fish was unhooked and released to its watery playground, perhaps a little more wise for the wear. It was a good start to an evening that was alive with all the fragrance and possibility befitting an early summer's eve. Working the shoreline, I tried several more spots with few takers. A great blue heron spooked from a hunt along the shoreline, and as it silently winged away with graceful strokes, I took pause. I pictured hundreds of other lakes where a different scene was playing out on this same evening. Large boats with large motors noisily raced from one spot to the next. Electronic fish finders removed much of the mystery as to what lied below. Fishing, like soda, comes in many different flavors to satisfy many tastes. As my eyes navigated me to the next spot, I remembered how I acquired my taste. My grandpa introduced me to the sport of fishing when I was 7. Each summer, I looked forward to the week-long vacation in the Minocqua area. Often, we'd take grandpa's 14-foot boat with 9-horsepower motor. My favorite trips, however, were when we'd load the rowboat in the back of the truck and try our luck at some backwoods lake. My grandpa would work us from one spot to the next, the squeaking of the oars always a part of the background. As we glided along, I would stare into the water, wondering what mysteries were hidden just beyond my sight. It seemed like such a peaceful, perfectly natural way to fish. I continued working my way around the lake, anxious to see what waited around the next corner. As often as not, spots that looked like sure things produced nothing, while more subtle covers produced action. A whippoorwill broke out in its frantic song, reminding me it's often the things we don't see, but are made aware of only by sounds or tracks that make our adventures ever more fulfilling. As I worked my bait back towards the boat, the twilight peace was again shattered as the water exploded. After several frenzied runs, a 30-inch northern pike came into the boat. The hula popper it had mistaken for a real frog, dangling from its upper jaw. I set the fish back in the water, where it disappeared with a splash of its tail. That seemed like a perfect way to end a memorable evening of fishing. As I guided my boat towards the shore, I couldn't help but think how at that moment, little had seemed to change since my grandpa rowed us around some other lake long ago. That explains my taste for simply fishing. The oars, squeaking and in need of oil, would probably annoy many people, but they made music to my ears. I think Grandpa would want me to leave them just the way they are.
Ron Weber is a forester and writer in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
This is Central Time. Earlier this year, a major spider collection with 10,000 specimens was donated to the UW Green Bay. Arachnologist John Casper collected the spiders during his 30-year career at UW Oshkosh. It's the largest collection of spiders in Wisconsin. Michael Draney will be working with the Casper Collection at UW Green Bay. He's with us now to talk about it and its significance to research and to the university. He's a professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, tell us about this Casper spider collection.
Well, like you said, Casper collected spiders throughout his career, starting in the 1960s when he was a student until his retirement just after the turn of this century. And he sort of kept the collection at home after his retirement. He was sort of working to transfer it to us, and unfortunately he passed away at the end of last year, and so his wife has sort of helped us to bring the collection to UW Green Bay, probably partly because he's good friends with the curator of the museum here. Tom Erdman is the curator of the Richter Museum of Natural History, and also because I'm just about the only spider biologist in the state, and so he figured that you know, the expertise would be useful to curate his collection.
That's got to be exciting for you as a spider researcher. So how are you going to use this collection in your research?
Yeah, it is really exciting. It's valuable for several reasons, partly because he identified a huge number of the material, a huge number of the specimens, and so we can use those specimens as a reference to identify other things. Also, there's a lot of undetermined material, which I'm excited to look at and see what's there. But probably the most important thing is the historical value of these specimens, because they really represent almost the only spiders that were collected, at least in any numbers, during the 90s, 80s, 70s, and 60s. And so in order to compare what we have today with what used to be in Wisconsin, it's really the most important resource that we have.
Well, I want to take a look at the spiders we encounter in Wisconsin. I understand you're doing research on cellar spiders.
Yeah, that's right. And this is a good example of how we're using this collection, you know, to help us in our research. So I'm doing some work with Joey Kilmer, who's a student at UW-Milwaukee, and he's studying these small cellar spiders. It's one species that seems to have become more common this century in Wisconsin. And after confirming what they were, we realized there's a larger species that used to be more common, and we were kind of wondering when did these two species, you know, get to Wisconsin. They were both here, you know, when I got to Wisconsin in, you know, 1999. And so looking back into John Casper's collection, we see that the larger spider has actually been in Wisconsin as long as Casper has been collecting, since the 1960s. It seems to have always been common. The smaller one that Joey Kilmer is studying, really the first one that we can find was collected by my friend, a high school teacher now, John Dobbins, who was Jack Casper's student in 1989. So the smaller spider seems to have arrived in the late 80s, early 90s, about the same time that the zebra mussel showed up in the Great Lakes.
Interesting. So there are spider invasive species, or is that too strong a phrase to use about the cellar spider?
Yeah, I think it's too strong a word. It's definitely a non-native species.
Okay.
These species are from Europe and Asia. But these two spiders cannot survive outside, certainly not through a Wisconsin winter. So really, they're not really invasive unless you consider they're invading your basement.
Well, and you mentioned surviving through the winter. I understand a lot of spiders, the native ones especially, do survive through the Wisconsin winter. Obviously, I guess they must.
Yes.
How do they do it?
Yeah, it is pretty amazing to think that every single one of them, there's more than 500 species of Wisconsin spiders, and they all have to find a way. And amazingly, you think it might be like surviving in some sort of inactive state, like an egg, but almost all of our spiders, maybe all of them, survive either as an adult spider or as an immature sub-adult spider. What they do is when the days start to become cool, they begin to produce antifreeze compounds in their blood, and it lowers the freezing point of their blood and their cells so that they don't freeze at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. They might freeze at 25 or 23 degrees Fahrenheit. And so then they can go underneath the snow, maybe underneath leaf litter or in cracks of bark in trees, and they can, it's just warm enough that they can survive. And so freezing is really their big problem. They're not really worried about the cold per se, but freezing is the big problem.
So 500-ish species of spider here in Wisconsin. There are people who are freaked out by all of them. Can you make the case that we shouldn't find spiders creepy? We should find them interesting, fascinating?
Absolutely. I mean, they are definitely a natural part of our environment. They were here in Wisconsin before humans were, and they're good for ecosystems and really for us because they eat all sorts of insects that eat our crops and that, you know, bother us, like mosquitoes. And also, I have to say that most spider species cannot bite humans. Most spider species are very small, and if they're smaller than a couple, maybe a quarter of an inch, then they're too small to really break human skin and bite us. And the ones that are big enough, they can bite, but spiders do not feed on people or attack people. They only bite in self-defense. So if you're not picking a spider up with your bare hands, it's actually quite unlikely, and it's a fairly rare event for someone to be bitten by a spider.
Mike, thanks a lot for being with us. Hope to talk to you again about the spiders of Wisconsin.
All right, great talking to you, Rob.
That's Michael Draney, professor of biology, chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW-Green Bay, talking with us about the Casper spider collection donated to the university there earlier this year. Coming up, Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency yesterday in 8 northwestern Wisconsin counties after major storm and flooding. We'll get the latest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, a new study says concerned parents should not comment on what their children weigh. We talked to an adolescent health expert about what parents can do to keep their kids healthy and at a healthy weight. First, yesterday, Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency for 8 counties after flooding caused by storms on Monday. Danielle Kading joins us now. She's the WPR News reporter based in Superior. Danielle, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
Well, we've been seeing news and pictures of these storms up there. What's it like in the affected counties in northern Wisconsin right now?
It's just shocking and surprising. Nobody who comes up to these roads expects to see the kind of devastation that you see where complete sections of the road are completely gone, where you have 100-foot gaps in some parts along major highways, There's two major washouts on Highway 13, so people can't get north to south from Ashland to Mellon right now going that route. And then on U.S. Highway 2, if you go from Ashland to Hurley, people can't get through east to west. So in some cases, they're taking a detour that takes at least 2.5 hours to bring them from Ironwood or Hurley all the way around, doing a loop underneath to get back to U.S. Highway 2 by Iron River.
So these are the main roads that you use to get around up there.
Yeah, this is what really connects the northern Wisconsin area and keeps them doing business with the rest of the world.
What other, apart from the roads, which is bad enough, what other kind of damage do we see from these storms and the flooding?
Well, people are having sewage backed up into their basements and just general flooding their, roofs in their homes. There's also backups in mail because UPS can't drive the mail to where they need to go because of these detours. So people are just kind of cut off right now.
At last I've seen, there were at least two deaths attributed to the storm. And now Governor Walker's declared the state of emergency. Run through, what counties are we talking about here under this declaration?
I don't have that list in front of me, but it's at least Ashland, Bayfield, Iron, Sawyer, Washburn. There's probably another one that I forgot, but I think it's six or seven counties in northern Wisconsin that are affected by this, where you saw tiny streams, creeks, that you could hop across, grow, and just take out sections of road.
Amazing. So cleanup effort, this doesn't sound like it's going to be fast, Danielle.
No, this is going to be a long-term recovery and one that is not going to be paid for by the county because they simply just don't have the money in their budget. They'll be looking for state resources or federal resources to deal with this kind of damage.
And maybe it's too soon for people to have an answer to this as they assess the damage, but has anybody been speaking out about how long it's going to take before at least those roads are fixed up?
Nobody's been saying, I should backtrack. Bayfield County says they'll have the roads open by the end of the week, but that's with the areas that haven't been completely washed out. For the major areas where there's sections of road that are completely gone, that's going to take more time and effort, and so people are going to get used to detours over the next days and maybe weeks.
Well, Danielle, thanks. Drive safely. Good luck to you and everyone else up there.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter at the WPR Bureau in Superior. She joined us to talk about the extensive flooding in northern Wisconsin. Parents who are concerned about their children being overweight may not always know the best way to talk to their kids about health, exercise, and diet. Here's a clip from the movie Spanglish. Preteen Bernie is opening bags of clothes her mother unexpectedly bought for her and discovers they're all a size too small.
Eight.
What?
Eight. Eight.
Bernie.
Come on, listen.
What's
come
going on,
Bernie, you're
going
to do it and you're going to look beautiful. Oh, honey, you are going to lose that weight. And,
Bit over the top, the wrong approach. According to new research, a lot of parents may wonder whether or not to say something to their kids about their weight, how to balance concerns about childhood obesity against the risks of self-esteem problems, mental health concerns, and eating disorders. New study tackles that issue. The finding, don't directly address the weight. Find other ways to promote health. Diane Newmark-Stainer is a professor and division head of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. She's published research on this topic. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me and for addressing this topic.
Well, let's dive right into this issue. A parent worried about the health impacts of a child being overweight, should they directly address their concerns? Should they say to their kid, you're overweight, we need to do something?
Well, my philosophy is based on really decades of research on the topic and really looking at the intersection between what we know about obesity and what we know about adolescent child development and eating disorders. And what we have concluded can be stated in just a few words: talk less, do more. Talk less about weight, do more to help your children engage in healthy eating and physical activity. So my philosophy is to talk less about weight and see what you can do at home to have an environment that really helps foster good habits in our children, knowing that some of them will be larger and some of them will be smaller.
Let's dig into that one step at a time here. Let's start with talk less. So what is the damage when parents talk about their kids' weight and their concerns about their children's weight?
All right. Well, let me tell you about some of the results from our research. We've run a study for many years called Project EAT, Eating and Activity in Teens and Young Adults. And we've followed a cohort of about 2,000 young people over 15 years. And one of the things we looked at is, for example, if my child is overweight, okay, and whether or not I'm aware that that child is overweight, you know, does that make a difference in what I do and what happens in my children? And what we found was that parents who recognized that their children were overweight didn't really do anything healthier at home, didn't have more family meals, didn't serve more fruits and vegetables. The only thing they did differently was encourage their children to diet to lose weight. And what we saw longitudinally was those children who were encouraged to diet ended up gaining more weight over time. So what we see is that good intentions can sometimes backfire. We also know that encouraging children to diet, talking about weight in the home, particularly having derogatory comments, weight teasing, weight-related bullying, not only predict disordered eating behaviors and poor body image, but place young people at risk for greater weight gain over time. So that's why we want to talk less about these topics. It doesn't mean that we never talk about weight. It doesn't mean that we never talk about food or being healthy or being active. But we try to place the focus on behaviors, not on the outcome of weight. And then the second part is to do more. You may want to ask me about that. But really to model behaviors we want to see in our children and provide family meals, you know, be active together, but really the focus is on the behaviors. That's what's under our control.
And I want to dig more into the behaviors, but spending just a bit more time on the talk less side
yes.
of things. I wonder, flipping things around, if parents are complimenting their children for being thin or looking healthy or things like that, could that ultimately have similar bad effects?
It can if that's what is seen as being valued. So I've started in my own personal life or when I meet children, you know, often we'll say something like, oh, you're so cute, you're so pretty. And not that we should never say that, but trying to comment on non-appearance-related factors, like, you know, you look strong, you're being so kind to your friends. It shows our children what's important to us. So if when we see people, we say, you look great, you lost weight, or you look so thin, or what'd you do, it's reinforcing the what we see as important.
All right, that's the talk less side. Let's get to do more now, and you've started to touch on this already.
Yeah.
You've got that parent. They're concerned. Maybe they see that their kid is a little overweight. Maybe they've even heard from a physician that this is a concern.
Yeah.
What are some of the first things they should do more of?
So really what I advise parents to do in that situation is the same thing that I would advise them to do if their child was not overweight, because engaging in healthy eating and physical activity is important for everyone regardless of their weight. So one of the things that we have studied in our research is family meals and the importance of getting our families together to eat, to provide this opportunity for coming together for conversation, to eat a healthier meal than our children might eat on their own, for checking in with how our children are doing. And we've done a number of studies on this topic, and again we see the benefits of engaging in family meals. Secondly is having food at home that we want our children to eat. So in my mind, and this is maybe based on being a mother of four children rather than on hard data from research, we want most of the food in our home to be healthy, but we also want to have other foods there that we can eat in small or moderate doses. So we kind of are modeling that all foods can be eaten, but we want to eat more of the healthier foods. Don't even have to talk about it. We just model it. And then the other side of the equation is being physically active. So what do we role model? What do we do with our families? Do we engage in any types of activities? And how can we increase those physical activities in a way that we're not doing them in order to burn calories or to lose weight, but because they're part of our lifestyle, they make us feel better.
I'm talking to Diane Newmark-Stainer from the University of Minnesota, looking at how parents could talk and behave around their children when it relates to health. A new study indicates that it's best if parents don't comment on their children's weight or a need to diet or things like that. I want to know what you think now at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue in your home, in your dinner table? Have you tried to address nutrition or weight issues with your child, or did your parents do that with you? How? Did they suggest politely that you needed to lose weight or diet? Did they model good behavior? Did they suggest less politely that there was a problem? What has worked, what hasn't worked in your life and in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up our conversation now with Diane Newmark-Stainer. She's professor and division head of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Talk about how parents can talk to their kids about staying healthy, or even not so much talk as model good behavior. New study says parents should avoid commenting on their kids' weight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent, how have you handled these issues? Are you worried about childhood obesity, trying to figure out how to create a healthy atmosphere, healthy habits for your kids? As a kid now or in the past, do you think you got a bad message from your parents, your peers, your friends? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I wanted to ask before we go to our callers, Diane, modeling is a word you used, and I've heard from other child behavior experts, really modeling is the key. If you smoke, your kids are more likely to smoke. If you display anger, your kids are more likely to display anger. And it sounds like if we eat healthy food, we get some exercise, our kids are more likely to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the most potent thing is what our environment is like. What foods do we have available? You know, are we providing opportunities for our kids to be active? And then modeling. What are we ourselves doing? And, you know, I like to say I like to model eating fruits and vegetables, eating dairy, eating whole grains, but also model eating a piece of cake, one piece of cake, and really enjoying it and not making comments, oh, my gosh, I shouldn't have eaten this cake, I broke my diet, I feel so bloated, or whatever it is. I think that's all a part of what we teach our children. And I should have told you, I wrote a book on this topic, which may be helpful for parents. It's based on our research, and it's called I'm Like So Fat, Helping Your Teen Make Healthy Choices About Eating and Exercise in a Weight-Obsessed World. And in this book, I really try to address the concerns that parents have about wanting their child to be at a healthy weight, but also wanting their child to feel good about him or herself.
Let's bring our callers on now. We've got Rich joining us. Rich, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think differently from your guest. I work in nutrition, and I'm a physical therapist that works down on the border of Mexico in the winter. And it's much more complicated than the simplicity that you're trying to make it. What it is you have ethnic groups that you know, tamales and whatever food they eat. So, I mean, I set them up with a nutritionalist, and I try to make them understand the right way to eat. But what you have is you have usually a single-parent family. And if it's two, they both work, and they're making minimum wage. And when they do end up coming home at night, they don't have time to prepare a meal, especially a nutritious meal, so they take them to McDonald's or any of the other fast food chains.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring our guest in here. So Rich pointed towards some problems, including for a lot of families, that family meal, it's hard to pull together.
Yeah, so I want to say that don't actually think we're in great disagreement. In this situation in which we have people living in poverty or living in stressful situations, it certainly is not going to help to talk about weight with our children, talk about certainly not having teasing about weight. That's going to add additional stress. Certainly going to a healthcare professional and talking about nutrition and learning about nutrition is important, but what's really going to be important is taking a look at the environment, both within the home and the neighborhood, to see how can we make eating healthfully and being physically active easier to do. And not simplifying the situation, because we're dealing with extreme stresses of people, of peoples, and those need to be taken into account.
Rich, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Diane Newmark-Stainer from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health about how to approach, for parents, how to approach issues of obesity and weight for kids. New research, including research she's done, says don't talk about the weight. Don't make fun of the weight. Don't suggest dieting. Provide healthy habits. Model healthy behavior. Back to our calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Lisa on the line in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hello. I agree with the doctor. I think the important thing is to focus on the foods that you have available and talk about things like having a colorful plate, which includes vegetables and fruits, and that options for snacks can be something like peanut butter on wheat bread with carrots, rather than chips. I believe that that's important to have those foods available, and also to teach your children how to cook and to maybe say to them, okay, let's include a fruit and a vegetable, and include all the food groups.
Interesting.
And so you're talking about, the food itself rather than directing any types of, criticism or talking about their weight.
Lisa, thanks a lot. Diana, what she said you agree with, I assume, but also she brought in that point of teaching kids to cook and
yeah,
bring them in on the process.
Yeah, I love what Lisa said. First of all, because those are behaviors and conversations that we want to have with every child, regardless of the child's weight. The point about cooking is really important, because this is something that we lost. We're seeing a growing interest in cooking and gardening and getting in touch with food, and teaching our children how to cook, again, by modeling, by certainly doing it, and then involving them as much as works within your family. And I think it's important to figure out ways to cook foods that are both healthy and easy, because realistically, that's what's going to happen most days.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Diane, I wanted to ask, you're saying talk less, do more. But maybe the parent isn't the one who brings this up. Maybe it's the child, the teen, him or herself, knows they're overweight, heard it from a doctor,
yeah,
heard it at school. Say the kid brings this up. What do you recommend a parent say to that?
Okay, so first of all, I want to say that I am not saying never, ever talk about weight. And in particular, when a child brings it up, you absolutely want to talk about it. What you don't want to use is use that as an opportunity to help the child feel worse about themselves. But so you might say, I think you look great. Weight is a part of our health, so it's something we all need to think about. But it's much more effective to think about, how are we eating and are we being active? And those are behaviors that we want for all children. And I'm willing to work with you if you would like to, figure out how we can eat healthier at home. That might be one response. Another response is I'd want to know where that came from. Did the child get teased at school? Did someone say something? And in that case, I wouldn't want the conversation to start talking about eating and food, eating and physical activity, but letting the child know that no one should be teased about his or her weight, that is unacceptable, just like no one should be teased about their socioeconomic status or their race, whatever it may be, or their intelligence level. Weight also comes out in that category. And then kind of exploring what happened, how the child feels about it, and thinking about ways to deal with it.
Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Diane Newmark-Stainer with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, talking about kids' health and conversations about weight. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.